So setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now allowing your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, and bring your attention to your own mind. Observe your own mind and any mental events arising in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images. Observing them arise and pass without grasping, without becoming distracted. Now, are any of the mental events arising in the mind, are any of these physical in nature? Are any of these appearances physical? Not the object of the thought or the memory or the image, but the actual mental event itself. Is it physical? Is it made up of atoms? Or are mental events the nature of the mind? Investigate. Now turn your attention to sense objects. So now focus on the visual domain in the space in front of you, any sensations in the body, any sounds, and observe these objects. Now, are any of these sensory appearances physical in nature? So remember again, we're talking about the appearances and not what that appearance refers to. The actual appearance to your mind, is it physical? Are these appearances made of atoms? Or are appearances of also are also appearances of sensory objects, the nature of the mind. The only world we can know is the world of appearances. And if all appearances are mental, not physical, not made of atoms, then isn't the world of experience the nature of our mind? And how could we possibly validate any physical world independent of our experience? A physical world independent of experience is unknowable. So let's go back in the text to the Chittamatra assertions. And again, if we go to the beginning there and we talk about the definition, it says, a proponent of Chittamatra is a person propounding Mahayana tenets who does not assert external objects, but does accept truly existent cognition. So let's see some of the reasonings and thinking that they use to refute external objects. So for this, again, we'll go into this text here, this tenets text here. It's on page 190. So here's the actual sort of the root text, and then there's some commentary on the root text. It says, because no external objects exist in the perspective of meditative equipoise, that's one reasoning, because regarding one thing there are many mental consciousnesses, that's two. Third one is because the pleasant and unpleasant arise together, is the third reasoning. The fourth is because appearances are controlled by yogis, etc., is the fourth. And the fifth is because the appearance of external objects is similar to dreams, etc., external objects do not exist and that they are just mind is true. So the commentary on that says the following. Chittamatrans assert that there are no external objects because, the first one is, objects such as forms, etc., do not appear to the uncontaminated, exalted wisdom consciousness of superiors. So the reasoning is they don't exist because they do not appear to meditative equipoise of an Arya being. An Arya being is someone who's realized nature of reality directly. So the reasoning here would be that if we're directly realizing how things really are and no external phenomena exist, that means there are no external phenomena. And there's a footnote on that. It says that in meditative equipoise on emptiness, only emptiness appears to the exalted wisdom consciousness. The argument assumes that if something existed, surely it would appear to the highest type of consciousness. So that's the first one. The second one, second point. When the three, and this is something we often see in the Chittamatra texts, when the three beings, gods, humans, and hungry ghosts, see a thing, for instance, water, a plurality of mental awarenesses arise for which nectar, water, or pus appears in accordance with their own karma. So the theory is that if there was an external reality, then even if three different beings saw that independent reality, they should see the same thing. But what we have here is that if we have some liquid, then for the Arya, for the god or the deva, it appears as nectar. For human, water, and for a preta, sort of pus and blood. So this is the reasoning they give to prove that there can't be an external reality. Because if there was, the three different beings should see the same thing. And there's a footnote on that. It says, the idea is that since it is not possible for one thing to be three different substances, in the instance in which different types of beings experience different perceptions in the same place, there must not be external objects present. Rather, these beings must be experiencing only the projections of their own karma. So that's the second reasoning they use to assert no external objects. The third one is when one person is simultaneously seen by enemies and friends, the pleasant and unpleasant arise together. And so the footnote here is, it is argued that since one person can be seen as a friend and an enemy by two different observers, the appearance of that person must not be an external object. Similar idea. The fourth is, earth appears as water in accordance with whatever is imagined in yogic appearance, i.e. the appearances for a yogi or in a yoga. So the footnote here is, yogis doing certain meditative practices validly see water where others would see earth. It is thus argued This, it is argued, must indicate that there are no external objects. And then the fifth one is the appearance of objects is similar to dream objects, etc. And the footnote here is, it is argued that it is perfectly possible to have vivid experiences in the absence of external objects, as in the case of dreams and waking visions. So they argue that since in a dream there appears to be an external reality when there is not, then they use that as an example of, in the waking world, also therefore it could be, it's possible to have an appearance of an external world when in fact there is no external world. So they use the example of a dream to show that maybe also in the waking state it's similar to a dream. Of course, the Prasangikas also use a dream analogy, but they have a different interpretation of that, and we'll see that later. And then there's two more things here. In the next section it says, and this relates is going to relate to a little bit later in the Chittamatra when we talk about selflessness or emptiness. There's another reasoning here. It says, since objects are not by their own nature established as reference of conceptual consciousness, their appearance as that to non-conceptual consciousnesses is mistaken, whereby it is refuted that those objects and consciousness are different substantial entities. So there's commentary on that. But what it means is that since objects are not established, naturally established as reference for our conceptions of them, so this here appears to be naturally, from its own side, a basis for giving the name cup. But the argument is that that is not established from its own side as a natural basis for applying the term cup. If it was, it would imply that it would have to be an external entity. So the commentary on that says, when those objects, i.e. all phenomena, are seen as being without their own measure of subsistence, as being the reference of conceptual consciousness, then through knowing that even to a non-conceptual sense consciousnesses, there are appearance of objects as existing by way of their own nature as reference for conceptual consciousness, one understands that those appearances are false. So even though it appears to even our sense consciousness that exists from its own side as a basis for applying the term cup, but we understand that that appearance is false, therefore, that can't be existing as an external object. Thereby, it comes to be refuted that the two, those consciousnesses and the objects, are different substantial entities. And then there's one other reasoning they use for refuting external objects. Remember, in the lower two schools, we talked about partless particles as the basis. And so they're refuting partless particles. And their refuting is the following. It says, when a tiny particle is encircled by other particles, if the eastern side does not face the western direction, it is seen to have parts. If the eastern side does not face the western direction, it is seen to have parts. So either when we have those particles that come together, either they do face opposite sides, therefore they have parts. And if they don't, but if it does face west, there is no gross form. So the reasoning is, when one tiny particle is encircled by four tiny particles in the four directions, if that part of the central particle that is touching the particle to the eastern side does not face or touch the particle on the western side, that central particle would have parts. If it does face or touch both the eastern and western particles, that eastern particle would have to touch the western particle, whereby those tiny particles would be in the same place, whereby gross form would be impossible. So either the western side touches the eastern side of the neighbour particle, which means they have parts, or if it doesn't, they would have to actually be in the same place, which means you couldn't have gross form. So either way, they're refuting partless particles. And so through that refutation, then they assert there cannot be any external particles because of that reasoning. So that's some of the reasonings that the Chittamatra use to validate their claim that there's no external objects. Any questions about any of those points before we go back into the text here? Some of those points will come up a little bit in the following part, but if there's any questions... They're not. Yeah. So the argument here was, and that's going to come up later in the talk, selflessness, is that, for example, this cup, it seems to be naturally, from its own side, a basis for applying the term cup. And what we can understand, of course, that's not the case, that cup is something merely imputed on that basis. And so their argument is that if it was a natural basis from its own side for applying cup, it would have to be a different substantial entity than the consciousness, i.e. it would have to be an external entity. But because we understand that cup is merely imputed, that it's not naturally a basis for applying cup, it cannot be an external object. That's the reasoning here, i.e. they're not different substantial entities. So what we're going to see is when they say different substantial entities, they mean internal consciousness, external physical object. That's what it means by different substantial entities, that it's of the nature of the mind. It must be therefore of the nature of the mind. Correct. And that's another way of saying the same thing. There must be the nature of the mind.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things that are expressed from different perspectives, but actually they amount to the same thing. And we're going to see that in the selflessness. When we talk about selflessness or emptiness, there are two examples of what they say is emptiness, but actually they amount to the same thing. They imply the same thing, expressed from a different way, in a different way. Okay? So let's go back into the text here. So the divisions. So here in this text it's divided into this true aspectarian and false aspectarian. And what we see in the four Buddhist tenet systems chart is that we have the followers of scripture and the followers of reasoning. And in this text, it sort of indicates that they are fairly synonymous, but actually in this text here, it sort of refutes that idea because it says that there are some followers of scripture who follow a sangha who are true aspectarians and some are false aspectarians, and some followers of Dharmakirti who are true aspectarians and false aspectarians. But anyway, we'll look at this division here and see what it means for to be a true aspectarian and a false aspectarian. So again, to introduce that idea, we can look in this book here. It actually gives a bit clearer presentation of the difference between a true aspectarian and a false aspectarian. And the idea of the true aspectarian, false aspectarian is about whether or not appearances to a sensory consciousness are true or false in terms of appearing as a gross object. So what that really means is quite clearly described in here. So I'll read it out, and it's on page 417. It says the following. And it's quoting another tenets text called Precious Garland of Tenets by Jigme Wampo. It's another great Indian Tibetan master who has a text, and he talks about this. He says, proponents of mind only, or Chittamatra, of two types, to aspectarians and false aspectarians. Differences exist between these two groups because, and the first point is, an appearance of a blue patch as blue to an eye consciousness perceiving blue is the aspect that is the basis of debate between true and false aspectarians. So the basis of debate is this patch of blue that's appearing to an eye consciousness. True aspectarians assert that the appearance of blue as blue to an eye consciousness apprehending blue exists as it appears. So it exists as a gross object, that patch of blue. Whereas false aspectarians maintain that an appearance of blue as blue does not exist as it appears to an eye consciousness apprehending blue. So that's why they're called false aspectarians, because it seems to be a gross object, single gross object, but the false aspectarian is saying no, it's not. The reason is the following. The above presentation is true because both true and false aspectarians are similar in asserting that blue appears as blue to an eye consciousness apprehending blue. So they both accept that blue is appearing as blue. That's okay. They are also similar in asserting that a blue appears as a gross object to an eye consciousness apprehending blue, and that blue falsely appears to be an external object. So they both agree that that blue, that patch of blue that's appearing, falsely appears as an external object. So all Chittamatrans accept that. What they don't agree about is the following. It says, however, true aspectarians assert that the appearance of blue, the appearance of blue as an external object to the eye conscious and apprehending blue is polluted by ignorance. They accept that. All Chittamatrans accept that. But what they say is, but that an appearance of blue as blue, the appearance of blue as a gross object is not polluted by ignorance. So they say that the gross object exists as it appears as a gross object, that patch of blue. Whereas true aspectarian, a false aspectarian, say that the appearance of blue as a gross object is polluted by ignorance. So they say that the fact that that's appearing as a gross object is polluted by ignorance, because they assert that actually if it's a gross object, it must be external. So that's their assertion. But to clarify a little bit more, we can talk about what the true aspectarians are actually accepting, because here we have three types of true aspectarians. But let's have a look at the definition in the text first. So a true aspectarian, a proponent of Chittamatra who accepts that a perception apprehending form in the continuum of ordinary being does not engage, polluted by latency of ignorance, in the factor of its appearance as a gross form. So the fact that it appears as a gross object is fine. That's how it exists. Whereas a false aspectarian saying that appearance as a gross object is a mistaken appearance. That it, in fact, if it is a gross object, it would be actually an external object. Sure. They both refute, or they both accept, that the appearance of anything as an external object is an appearance polluted by ignorance. So to understand the true aspectarians, there's three types here. Proponents of equal number of apprehended objects and apprehending subjects, half-eggers and non-pluralists. Each have their own individual assertions. So I'll read out what it says in the text, and then we'll try and simplify it and understand simply what their assertions is. So the text says, it is said that the proponents of equal number of apprehended objects and apprehending subjects accept that when an eye consciousness apprehending the mottled colours on the wing of a butterfly apprehends the mottle, from the object side, the aspect of each different colour is delivered. So we have many things being delivered. And from the subject side, the aspect of each different colour, blue, yellow and so on, is produced in its true aspect. So for them, then, if we have many different aspects of the object, We have an equal number of aspects of subject apprehending each of those. So many objects, many subjects, many consciousnesses. The half-eggists says, when they accept that such is apprehended, from the object side, the aspect of each different colour is delivered, so there are many different aspects delivered. However, from the subject side, the aspect of each different colour, blue, yellow, and so forth, is produced in an aspectless manner, meaning you only have one subjective consciousness apprehending the collection. So many aspects presented, one aspect seen from the subject side. Whereas the non-pluralists accept that when such is apprehended, from the object side, the aspect of each different colour is not delivered, so you're not getting individual aspects being delivered, but rather the aspect of the mere conglomeration is delivered. So we get the conglomeration of all those different aspects delivered as one. And from the subject side, the aspect of each different colour, yellow, blue, and so forth, is not produced in an aspectless manner, but rather the aspect of the mere conglomeration is produced in an aspectless manner. Meaning, for the non-pluralists, even though there's a conglomeration of different aspects, one, the conglomeration is presented, and then one consciousness apprehending that is produced. So the equal number is many objective aspects, many subjective consciousness aspects. The half-eggers, many objective aspects, one consciousness produced apprehending that. And from the non-pluralists, one conglomeration appearing, one consciousness apprehending that. So that's a little bit of technical differences between them. I don't think we really need to go in any detail more about that. But if there's any questions about that. Right. But remember, we have to be careful when we talk about non-duality here. Non-duality here means no internal mind, external object. Not like in the Prasangika, where non-duality means no inherent, no independent object and subject. Because, as we're going to see a little bit later, because appearances are the nature of the mind, they are, for Chittamatra, independent of the mind.
So they still have that distinction of external objects, but their conclusion
is... No. What they have is, for the lower schools, there is an independent external object. And that is the cause for a consciousness apprehending it. Here, they would not accept that. One is that there's no external object, and two, it's not the cause producing the consciousness producing that. Because it's internal to the mind, and this comes up a little bit later, the appearance of the object and the consciousness apprehending the object occur simultaneously.
So it's not that the object, that the external...
Well, there's no external object.
It's not that the external object is arising from the mind, it's that they are arising with the mind.
So again, there's no external object in Chittamatra. But as we're going to see a little bit later, is that... And they use actually this to back up their claim in some of the sutras and texts, teachings of the Buddha. It talks about that the consciousness apprehends the object simultaneously. But actually in the Sautrantika Vaibhashika and Prasangika model, that's not the case, because the object produces the consciousness apprehending it. So they're cause and effect. Meaning that when we're aware of these flowers, The consciousness apprehending the flowers is actually apprehending something that was in the previous moment. So they're not simultaneous for Vaibhashika Satrajit and Prasangika, which we haven't looked at yet. But Chittamatrans say they're simultaneous. And so for them, the object and the subject arise or come into existence simultaneously. How that happens, we're going to look at what the mechanism for that is. And it's on that basis that they talk about then whether that appearance that rises simultaneously with the consciousness is true or false in terms of being a gross object. And then in terms of, for the true aspectarians, whether that object casts many aspects and there are many aspects of consciousness or many in one or one in one. That's debate within the Chittamatrans. They debate in the Chittamatrans that when they arise simultaneously, is that arising as a gross object? Is that appearance as a gross object polluted by ignorance? Of course, they all accept that the appearance as an external object is polluted by ignorance, of course. But whether or not the appearance as a gross object, is that a true appearance or not? True aspectarians say sure. False aspectarians say no. But then that true aspectarians is going, okay, that's a true appearance. It's not polluted by ignorance. But how does that work? Are there many aspects appearing and many subjective aspects? Or is there many aspects and one subjective aspect? Or is there only one aspect of the appearance and one subjective aspect? So there's within the true aspectarians, there's some differences of how that true appearance is, how that's working. I mean, they both say it's polluted by appearing as an external object, of course. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on then. And then it says there are two types of false aspectarians, tainted false aspectarian and untainted false aspectarian. So remember, a false aspectarian is that appearance as a gross object, it's polluted by ignorance, that it's that the fact that it appears as a single gross object is polluted. Because they say that if it's not being a gross object, it would necessarily imply that it would be external. So they can't accept that. So they say we've also got some ignorance in terms of the fact that that's actually appearing as a gross object. That's also a type of ignorance that we're polluted by. But then it talks about tainted and untainted here. The difference... Again, it's a technical point, but I'll just briefly mention it in here. And there is some discussion about what this means. There is some difference of opinion what actually tainted and untainted means here. So let's see what it says. Regarding false aspectarians, there are two. It is reputed, and so this is Jungyam Shaper, the Indian, the Tibetan commentator, he's saying it's reputed, which means I don't agree with it, but this is what earlier Tibetan masters say. He says, it is reputed that there are those false aspectarians who assert that even the conqueror, the Buddha, has taints of dualistic appearance. So he's saying earlier Tibetan masters say that a tainted false aspectarian, their assertion is that even an enlightened being is polluted by dualistic appearance. That's what they say tainted means. And those who assert that he does not, whereby they are renowned as tainted. So he's saying that some earlier Tibetan masters understood tainted and untainted in this way, that the tainted false aspectarians were the ones who thought that even a Buddha was still tainted by dualistic appearance. But he's not agreeing with that because he's basically saying, I don't think there's any Indian masters who would assert this. So his own assertion is, he says, what then are the two types of false aspectarians? So he laid out this idea and he said, I don't really accept that idea of tainted and untainted. He says, in our own system, those who assert that the entity of the consciousness that has the apprehended object aspect is polluted by stains are tainted false aspectarians, And those who assert that since stains are adventitious, the entity of the mind is not polluted, even though the aspect of the consciousness is mistaken, are regarded as untainted false aspectarians. So I think we can leave it at that. So that his assertion is basically that whether or not these stains are adventitious or not, I think we don't really need to go into that at all. So let's move right along into the next point. These are very minor technical points, not of any great interest, I think, in the what we're looking at. In etymology, it says, why are they called proponents of Chittamatra? They are called proponents of Chittamatra because they accept that phenomena are merely the nature of mind, i.e. not physical, not matter. And they are called proponents of cognition because they accept that all phenomena are merely the nature of cognitions, saying the same thing, really. So that's just the etymology. Chittamatra, mind only. Things are only of the nature of the mind. So let's go into the way of asserting objects. There are two types of object of knowledge: ultimate truth, conventional truth. So maybe for this we can have a look here. We've got a two truths chart, which I don't know if we even really looked at last week. So let's have a look at the two truths chart. So we saw that in the Vaibhashika and the followers of scripture, conventional truth and ultimate truth, the ultimate truth again was the partless particles and partless moments, and conventional truth, everything that's made up of those. And the followers of reasoning in Sautrantika, remember, ultimate truth is anything that can ultimately perform a function. So example there is a pot, and conventional truth were permanent phenomena. And the example here is a generic image of a pot, which is permanent, of course. Here in the Chittamatra, following this definition here, we see that ultimate truth, that which is realized by a valid perception, directly realizing it by way of the vanishing of dualistic appearance. And if we go down further to the conventional truth towards the bottom of page 14, that which is realized by a valid perception, directly realizing it by way of being together with dualistic appearance. So that's the definition of ultimate truth and conventional truth. And if we look at some synonyms for ultimate truth here, it says ultimate truth, final reality, sphere of reality, and final mode of abiding are equivalent. Here, final reality in Sanskrit is dharmata, and sphere of reality is dharmadhatu. So often we find, and of course, emptiness is shunyata. And often we find when we talk about emptiness, and this also comes in the Prasangika, we often find synonymous this word dharmata or dharmadhatu. Dharmata he has translated as final reality. Sometimes it's translated as nature of reality, ultimate reality, and sphere of reality is the translation of dharmadhatu. So these are just equivalent. So of course here, ultimate truth, final reality, sphere of reality, final mode of abiding. Also here we can use the word emptiness. Emptiness, of course, in Sanskrit is shunyata. But here, emptiness, of course, as we're going to see a little bit later, just coming up, is that there's no external world. That the consciousness and the object that it apprehends are empty of being different substantial substances, or different substances, meaning there is no internal mind and external physical world. So that's what emptiness means here. That non-duality of inner and outer. And if we look at the, it says there are two divisions of ultimate truths, subtle selfnesses of phenomena and subtle selfnesses of person. And it says, when subtle selfnesses of phenomena is divided by way of basis of emptiness, there are 20 emptinesses. When those are condensed, there are 18. When those are condensed, there are 16. When those are condensed, there are 4 emptinesses and so forth. So, of course, we can't divide emptiness, because emptiness is a permanent phenomenon, it's an uncompounded phenomenon, so there's no divisions. But it says here, when divided by way of basis of emptiness, meaning we can talk about, you know, emptiness of cup, emptiness of laptop, emptiness of flower. So they're different bases. And here he gives a presentation of 20, 18, 16, and 4. Here there's no information about what that division of bases of emptiness are. And I don't think it's the same or similar to the presentation we're going to see in the Prasangika. Also in the Prasangika, we can talk about dividing emptiness in terms of bases. And there we're actually going to give a very brief presentation of the 20, the 16, the 4 and the 2 and so forth. But here I'm not sure how they divide that up, so we won't go into that. But some illustrations of subtle selfnesses of phenomena. And for this also we can go to our chart. There is a chart we have here, the coarse and subtle selflessness chart. We can refer to that chart as well. So remember, in the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, there's no such thing as selflessness of phenomena. There's only selflessness of person, meaning how we see phenomena is okay in the Sautrantika Vaibhashika, that things, phenomena truly exist the way they appear, so no problem. So there's no self of phenomena that we're falsely grasping to. Whereas here in Chittamatra, what we see in selflessness of person is they also accept the same as Vaibhashika and Sautrantika. They also say that coarse selflessness of person is realizing there's no unitary, unchanging, independent person, and that subtle selflessness of person is realizing there's no self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So they're the same there. But they also say that how we see phenomena, deceptive. That phenomena appear to be external, but in fact they're empty of being external. So that is selflessness of phenomena. And that can be described in these two ways. The first one is emptiness that is a form and the valid cognition apprehending that form being empty of being different substances. So here different substances means the mind is mental, form is physical. That's different substances, i.e. that form is external and it's physical. But we can realize that that appearance as a different substance, as an external phenomena, is deceptive. That, in fact, the form and the mind that's apprehending it are empty of being different substances, meaning that there's no subject-object duality in terms of inner subject, outer object. That's emptiness, and that's how it's described. Effectively, emptiness means no external objects. Everything is internal to the mind, everything's nature of the mind. And the other one here, it says, emptiness that is the form being empty of existing by way of its own characteristics as a basis for applying the term form. So we saw how they refuted external objects is that for them, when we see, for example, this cup, it naturally appears to exist by way of its own side, from its own characteristics, as a basis for applying the term form. That's what it appears like, that is something from its own side that appears as a basis for applying the term form. But what we can understand is that form, or cup in this case, is simply a mental construct, a label that we're applying to it. It does not exist from its own side as that thing. Because the Chittamatrans say that if it did, it would have to imply that it would be external to the mind. So this emptiness of realizing that that is not existing by way of its own characteristics as a natural basis for applying the term cup is saying the same thing. So even though these are described differently, this selfness as a phenomenon, this emptiness, is the same. Any questions about those two? Specifically characterized phenomena? They wouldn't use that term, but a specifically characterized phenomena is, of course, impermanent phenomena, so that's for them other powered phenomena. Okay, time for a tea break. So let's have a tea break and we'll come back and forge on in the Chittamatra assertion and see if we can avoid getting lost.